From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by the investment banker turned banjo superstar, Alison Brown. My guest tonight, Alison Brown, started life on a track sure to make any yuppie parent proud. A Harvard degree, followed by an MBA at UCLA, followed by a promising career in investment banking with Smith Barney. All that rounded out by a successful hobby as a banjo player, so good that at age 14, the young American won the Canadian National Banjo Championship. But as Alison Brown climbed the corporate ladder, it was the banjo and bluegrass that were on her mind. While banking colleagues woke up thinking about a bond issue, Alison Brown was thinking about Earl Scruggs. Walking into the office, she'd tuck the latest issue of Bluegrass Unlimited behind copies of The Bond Trader. One day, her what if and why not questions piled up too high, and Alison left it all to pursue her music. It worked, and today Alison Brown is co-founder of a successful record label, Compass Records, and leads a quartet that has taken the banjo off the back porch and into Latin, Celtic, Cajun, and jazz music, without forgetting bluegrass. We caught up with Alison Brown this week in Nashville to talk with her about her music, her business, and her banjo. Alison Brown, good evening and welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. All right, first question, right out of the gate. Here we are, Americans across the country, working 9 to 5 and longer, day after day, got those suits on, got those business pumps on. You somehow got out of that racket, out of the rat race, out of the investment banker world, and back to your banjo. How did you accomplish that?
Well, I accomplished it in baby steps, really. I was working for Smith Barney in San Francisco, structuring tax-exempt bond issues. And after doing that for a few years, realized that I didn't really love tax-exempt debt all that much. And decided to just take a few months off and work on writing some music and studying a little bit of jazz, and then just go back and get a real job.
So this was in 88 when you took a sabbatical, sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And just as I was thinking about going back and getting another real job, I got a call from Alison Krauss to join her band. And really, every time there's been an opportunity for me to go back and get a real job, something's happened to keep me in music. But really, it was just a series of baby steps, more than one gigantic leap.
You're off with Alison Krauss and then Michelle Schacht, and then before long into your own label and your own albums, your own CDs. This didn't happen just out of nowhere. You had a musical background growing up.
To some extent. I mean, I discovered Earl Scruggs when I was about 10 years old, and just loved the sound of the five-string banjo. So, yeah, I started playing as a kid, although I was the only one in my family really to play an instrument, so it wasn't like I grew up with a lot of front porch picking down there in La Jolla, California, where I grew up.
What do you think made the difference between you playing your banjo and then ending up doing it as a career between that and producing records, and thousands of other kids who, you know, play their guitar, their banjo, their piano, and let it go? What stuck you with the instrument and made you so good at it?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, when I think about that, I just sort of feel like the banjo somehow chose me. And, you know, a lot of the artists on Compass, you know, one of the big words of wisdom that we offer to them is, if you can quit, you should. And in my case, I just couldn't quit. I mean, I just loved music too much. And when I was working for Smith Barney, I just kept thinking, you know, what could I accomplish if I could devote as much time to music as I was spending on bond refundings? And it was just a question that I couldn't let rest.
So when you say, if you can quit, you should, you mean, if you don't absolutely need to play your music, then let it go.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. I mean, there's so much competition out there these days, so many records and so many artists, and if you don't really have a tremendous fire in the belly for doing it, you probably should do something else. But in my case, I just had to do it.
Take us back, if you can, to that Earl Scruggs sound that first got its hooks into you when you were a girl. Can you give us a little bit of that on your banjo tonight?
Sure, yeah. Well, probably Earl's most famous tune, certainly one of the ones that I just loved early on, is this one, which you may recognize from the movie Bonnie and Clyde.
Earl Scruggs, and that is, of course, three-finger style, which was a breakthrough with Earl Scruggs, or something he really championed. What was the difference between that and what came before it in banjo Alison Brown?
Well, I'll do my best to illustrate it. I mean, before Earl came along, people were playing, if they were playing five-string banjo, they were probably playing it with their fingers, not with metal picks. So if you pick a banjo with your fingers, it's a lot quieter. Mm-hmm. And they were playing a little bit different style of banjo back in those days, too, but it might have sounded more like a... like that kind of picking sound.
It's a more hill country sound.
It's a lot simpler, and I believe folks were playing more with two fingers, a thumb and index finger, rather than all three fingers. And, of course, some people were playing the clawhammer style, which sounds more like that. Mm-hmm. It more involves brushing the strings with your nails and no picks at all. So Earl came along, and he figured out this three-finger style of playing, and that's what gives you kind of the really rapid notes and really exciting, you know, metallic, you know, metal on metal sound.
That comes there.
Yeah, that sort of car chase sound.
It worked in Bonnie and Clyde.
it sure did. I mean, he came up with this style called three-finger style. So when I play, I have a plastic pick on my thumb and two metal picks on my fingers. And Earl came up with this technique of playing rolls, like the Scruggs roll. That's the big popular thing. It sounds like this. From that, you can go into, like, all these really fast, exciting sounds. And that's really, that sound is what drew me to the five-string banjo.
Now, what are you doing in the Scruggs roll? You've got the pick on your thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you making that roll?
You kind of do a downward stroke with your thumb and then upward picking with your fingers. And just practice and practice and practice.
Let it rip a little more for us.
Oh, let's see. Another one of his was Cripple Creek.
You grew up in Connecticut, and then in San Diego. Your parents were lawyers, not exactly musicians, and bluegrass surely was not the dominant sound of your youth and teenage years in San Diego, California. What do you think it was about this sound that got its hooks into you?
I wish I could answer that question, and I'm not sure. It's some kind of cosmic thing. I mean, I just heard the sound of the banjo, and I just loved it so much, and I just had to learn how to do it myself. When we moved out to San Diego, I was about 12 years old, and I was really afraid that there wouldn't be any bluegrass music out in Southern California. And that was before I realized that Southern California is such a hotbed for bluegrass music, and it really was in the 70s. And I think that that's because a lot of folks moved to California from places like Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl and brought their love of country music with them. So when I was growing up out there in San Diego, I belonged to the local bluegrass club and went to all the festivals and contests. And even though the kids at my high school weren't listening to bluegrass, there was a lot of bluegrass to be heard and learned.
But there's something so absolutely American about the banjo and bluegrass.
Mm-hmm. It's ironic because the banjo is an African instrument. It didn't look like this banjo that I'm holding or weigh as much as the banjo I'm holding did when it came over from Africa with the slaves, but that's where the banjo originated.
What was it called in Africa, do you know?
I don't know. I think it probably sounded something like banjo, but I'm not positive. I know that it was made out of a gourd and had I've seen some of these old ones. They're really crude. I mean, they vaguely resemble the banjo I'm holding now. But they were banjos nonetheless.
The heart of the banjo still there. You jumped right on it. By 14, you had won the Canadian National Banjo Championship. I know that's a long time ago now, but I have to ask you, do many people turn out for that contest? I don't associate the banjo with Canada.
Believe it or not, yes, there were a lot of people there. There were all kinds of divisions of banjo, too. There was a ladies banjo, which I'm proud to say that I wasn't in that category.
All right.
And it was a huge event. It was very, very cool.
Your parents saw you off to Harvard, and you were looking at pre-med, and then eventually ended up in an MBA program. They had big career aspirations for you. You eventually stepped off, as you described, the Smith Barney carpet and into music. What have they made of that over all these years? They clearly had other plans for you.
Well, my parents, they have a lot of common sense between them, and I must admit that now being a parent myself, I can certainly see the wisdom in suggesting that your daughter pursue playing banjo as an avocation rather than a vocation. And initially when I quit my day job, they were less than thrilled. In fact, there was a very long pause on the other end of the phone line when I told them I'd quit my job at Smith Barney. However, when I took them to the Grammys, they started to feel much better about it.
Right. Talk to us about Replay. It came out last year, and this came out of a session that you did with your quartet, the Alison Brown Quartet, which includes your husband, Gary West. And give us the rest of the band.
Well, a bunch of guys I've been playing with for a long time. John Arbour, who's from Oakland, California, mm-hmm. on piano, mm-hmm. and Kendrick Freeman, who's from Petaluma, California, on drums. And kind of the genesis of the project was that I really wanted to go in the studio and record music that had lived and breathed. And all the records I've done in the past really have been a case of me writing the music and going into the studio and kind of putting the final touches on it and trying mm-hmm. to record it. Mm-hmm. So I thought it'd be fun to do the opposite. So with the quartet, we just went in the studio for 2 days and just wanted to play through the tunes that we do live that folks really seem to like, mm-hmm. and then kind of have a living sort of document that sort of shows what the quartet sounds like at this point in time.
I love Shoot the Dog, where the quartet really gets going and the drum really gets involved here. It's a real thrumming beat running through there. Was this your composition, Alison Brown?
Yeah, it was a tune that I wrote about my grandma's dog, Woofy.
Tell us the story.
Well, spent the longest 4 days of my life down there in Cottondale, Florida with my grandma one time, and she had this dog that didn't get along very well with me. I guess it was mutual. And so that was a tune that I wrote for Woofy.
Banjo enthusiasts, banjo traditionalists, think about the ways in which you've taken the banjo, Alison Brown.
Well, enthusiasts are one thing and traditionalists are another in bluegrass music. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there are a lot of traditionalists that believe that the banjo was perfect just the way Earl was playing it with Bill Monroe and Lester Flatt in 1945, mm-hmm. and would just be happy for it to stay that way. But I think as a whole, banjo enthusiasts tend to be kind of a broad-thinking bunch. And a lot of banjo players like to try to push the envelope for the instrument. And I think for those folks, you know, they're really happy to see the music evolve a little bit. But that is one of the things about bluegrass music. The traditionalists like it the traditional way. And for those folks, seeing a banjo with piano and bass and drums isn't necessarily the best thing.
I saw a little notice here that you were speaking, the keynote speaker at the World of Bluegrass Trade Show in Louisville recently. So somebody out there in the business is interested in hearing from you.
Yeah, well, you know, like I was saying, that's something that's maybe it's not that particular to bluegrass music, so I think the same thing is true in jazz, where the traditionalists want to kind of keep the music the way it was 50 years ago. But, you know, in the IBMA, or the International Bluegrass Music Association, for mm-hmm. whom I did this keynote address, mm-hmm. there are a lot of people who like to see the music, who believe that for the music to evolve and to stay vital, it needs to grow. And other influences need to be incorporated into it. And I think that was probably why they invited me to do the address for them.
We'll talk more with Alison Brown after a short break. This is the Spider-Man theme, a song from her latest CD, Replay. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour to the banjo superstar, Alison Brown, from her latest CD, Replay. This is Late on Arrival. Moved on a good ways from Earl Scruggs. You can hear the echo, but you've taken it into areas that are more, maybe more melodic, even a kind of cool jazz feeling behind some of this. Is that your imprint?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I guess I love bluegrass-style banjo playing, but as we say in the South, I mean, there are a lot of guys who can really lay the thumb to the five really well, maybe better than I can, and do that kind of hard-driving bluegrass thing. So when I started to write music, I sort of felt like that might be the way that I could make a contribution to the instrument. And I think really kind of the jazziness of the quartet lends itself as much to the tremendous abilities of the band as to me, really. I mean, I kind of contribute the tune, and then those guys really do so well at coming up with, like, the right groove to put behind the melody and that kind of thing.
But you're not a purist about it. I mean, some of these songs go right out of the bluegrass songbook and off in entirely different directions. You're perfectly happy to leave the straight and narrow behind.
Yeah, well, I think that that's because when I try to write music, the hardest thing for me to write is bluegrass tunes. I mean, if you think about it on the banjo, there's all those great Earl Scruggs tunes, and then how do you come up with a tune that sounds like an Earl tune that's original? It's really challenging. So, I've tended to embark on a kind of a more melodic direction, I guess. And teams seem to come up with melodies that take me into places other than bluegrass, like you're saying, Latin directions and maybe a little bit of a Celtic direction every now and then.
Let's talk about how you got off in that direction. You ended up with Alison Krauss not long after your famous sabbatical in 88, bluegrass fiddler, and playing banjo for her with Union Station. You'd been with a lot of bands before that. What was it like to travel and play with Alison Krauss?
Oh, it was so fun. It was really great. Because I'd spent years and years reading Bluegrass Unlimited, and growing up in Southern California, we didn't really get a lot of chance to see all the, like, the big national touring acts, bluegrass acts. So I was kind of like living this bluegrass thing vicariously through reading Bluegrass Unlimited. So when I joined Allison's band, just having a chance to travel around the country, kind of live the bluegrass life, go to the places where the music came from, and play with people actually from North Carolina and Southern Appalachia, it was a tremendous thing.
Can you still feel the influence of that time with Alison Krauss in your music today? How would you point to it?
Oh, sure. I mean, maybe not so much in the sound of what we do, but just kind of the experience of having done that and having gotten to play with guys who can really lay the thumb to the five. I mean, the kind of the sense of time and taste that Union Station has and that Alison brings to that band is just really unique, and it was an invaluable education.
Following Alison Krauss, you were touring with Michelle Schock, and here the business and musical sides of your life, are they being melded together?
No, they were about to converge, but I was actually band leader for her tour. My responsibilities were all very much on the musical side of things. Mm-hmm. But it was during the course of that year that I met and started playing with Gary West, who's become my husband and also the co-founder of Compass Records. And, you know, kind of sitting, riding the bus, we sort of felt half satisfied. I mean, it's great to play music, but you spend like 22 hours of the day just in kind of getting in position to play music those 2 hours, you know what
mm-hmm,
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we were sitting in a cafe in Stockholm, Sweden one day, and we pulled out a napkin and we started sketching out, making the sketch of the good life. And, you know, what could we do in addition to play music that you know, we would kind of use the other side of our brains as well. And that's how we came up with the idea of launching a record label and trying to help and support other artists and bring their music out, as well as continuing to play our own.
So at Compass now, you've achieved something like this, I think what a lot of career people would think of it as the dream. You've got a business going, you've got your music going at the same time. You've put out something like 100 albums from Compass now. Eclectic mix. Your first release was Music on the Didgeridoo. You've had jazz bassist Victor Wooten and Czech bluegrass. Is there a unifying theme there?
Oh, if I had to pick one, it would just be my musical aesthetic, really, mine and Gary's. We just put out music that we like, and it tends to be music that's very melodic. And if it has words, the words tend to be maybe a little bit on the poetic side.
Mm-hmm. That melodic theme is attached to your music a lot as well. As you've moved on beyond the kind of Earl Scruggs sound of early inspiration, clearly there's melody really woven through a lot of the quartet's music. Can you pull out some of that for us? Give us a sense. Let us just hear the banjo in your hands, Alison Brown, at work behind the quartet.
Well, I'll try. I can play a little bit of a tune that's sort of Celtic inspired, but what makes it a little bit different from the banjo's point of view is it's a little bit more chordal, whereas the Scruggs style is based around the roll, the way we were talking about. This is based more out of playing arpeggios and chords. Mm-hmm. But this is a tune I wrote about a monk named St. Brendan, and I'll play a little bit of it for you.
Not in Earl Scruggs land anymore. You've been described as having a rock and roll guitar style of playing the banjo. What does that mean? And do you agree?
I guess it's a compliment. I mean, it might refer to kind of a single string style that some of us, you know, more progressive banjo players use. There was a man named Don Reno who was a contemporary of Earl Scruggs, and he came up with this way of playing single string lines on the banjo like this. Of a Don Reno tune called Follow the Leader. Well, the advantage of doing that is that you can play melody kind of note for note, whereas in Earl Scruggs style, you need to try to weave the melody into a roll. Mm-hmm. If you're playing it alternating your thumb and index finger, you can play a melody note for note. And so maybe that's what they're referring to, is occasionally, you know, kind of incorporating some of those single string lines.
Mm-hmm. Have you found territory where the banjo just won't go, where your composing might want to take it, but it's the instrument's just not cut out for X, Y, or Z?
Not really, because most of the composing that I do is on the banjo, so it kind of necessarily sort of has to work. I mean, one of the challenges of the acoustic banjo is that it's a very staccato instrument when the notes die away really quickly, which is one of the reasons why on our Out of the Blues CD we came up with this electric nylon string banjo as a way to get around the kind of quick decay of the notes. This electric nylon string banjo sounds a lot like an electric guitar, I guess, or it sounds like a jazz guitar, which is what it was intended to sound like. And with that instrument, you can play one note and have it ring.
Is that what you're playing on the cut called G-Bop on replay?
Oh, no, that's just a regular banjo playing a lot of notes. I think that's why banjo players play so many notes, in fact, is just to kind of keep the notes coming.
Because you know, it doesn't have that long sustain.
Exactly. The Out of the Blue record featured the electric nylon string banjo on quite a few tracks, I think. The title track for one and a couple others as well.
Let's listen for a second to how you used all those notes to fill it up with a very jazzy sound on cut entitled G-Bop. Thank you.
Now, take that, Earl Scruggs. That's a long way from Rocky Top.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, that the banjo started in jazz, and then Earl came along and invented this three-finger style, which is the kind of style I'm using to sort of take the banjo back towards jazz. Mm-hmm. So it's all kind of coming full circle in some sort of way.
You're in Nashville now with Compass Records, Connecticut, California girl, now in Nashville country. How's that work? Is it an open culture? Does it embrace someone like you who's not born and raised in that fold?
Yeah, Nashville is one of those communities that's really drawn a lot of people from the coasts as well as other places just because of the music industry, which has become such an international community really here at this point. And even though country music's probably our most well-known export, there are musicians that live here that play all kinds of music. So it's a great place to be for a musician. And from a practical point of view, we can really tour almost anywhere in the country, at least on this side of the Rockies, is kind of driving distance from Nashville, which is why a lot of musicians live here.
And what's your sense of the ethos there now? What dominates? Is it country? Is it country pop? Is it a more pop sound? What's the driving energy in Nashville these days?
That's really hard to say. I suppose from an economic point of view, it would be the country music that you hear on the radio these days, which, you know, I don't know what that is. It sounds like 80s pop to me, but it's called country music these days. And that's probably generating kind of the most dollars in Nashville. But, you know, obviously bluegrass music is getting a good bit of attention these days because of the success of the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack and Alison Krauss and Union Station and Nickel Creek. All those acts are really raising the profile of that music. So we're finding more of that in town, too.
Is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou seen as a kind of lightning strike? You know, Oh Brother, please give us more of those, Lord. Is that enough to sustain the bluegrass neck of the woods?
Oh, I don't know if you can look at something like that. That's such a phenomenon. You know, it's really kind of a coffee table record in my book. You know, 6 million people have bought that record. I don't know how many of those people will buy another bluegrass record. But it's certainly been great to raise the profile of the music, and hopefully some of those people will become longtime bluegrass fans.
Now, you're an MBA. You were an investment banker. How do you look at this? Now you're both in the business side and on the musician side. I guess Compass Records could come out with an album that just went through the roof, or you could personally compose, perform, or put out one of your own that went through the roof. As a businesswoman, are you trying to put out a long string of records that do well enough, or do you have to be looking for the big score?
Well, that's the really big difference between the way we run our label and the way the major labels operate. The major labels count on having huge successes. They really need to have records that sell millions of copies in order to support their infrastructure. And our business is run so differently, it's almost as though we're in a different business completely, because we've built Compass Records to last on a series of small successes. I mean, records don't need to go through the roof for them to be economically viable and help keep our doors open. And that's really the way we want it to be. I mean, we're here. If something really explodes, that'll be great. But if it doesn't, we'll still be here.
And who's your market? Do you aim different releases at a different market that you visualize? Or is there one group of Americans who are buying this more eclectic kind of music?
Well, it's kind of a broadly defined niche. We like to think of our audience as the NPR listener. I mean, folks who are really interested in discovering different kinds of music and are kind of bored with the pablum that's served up by and large by commercial radio. So that's a broad demographic, but that tends to be the case. I mean, kind of 25 to 65 years old, and folks who are looking for music with some substance and want to apply their brains to the process of listening to it.
This is On Point. And the banjo, it doesn't always get a lot of respect, despite its deep roots in American music.
No, it's the butt of more jokes than any instrument I could think of, except maybe
that?
The accordion.
Why?
Oh, well, why? I mean, I think I loved hee-haw, but I don't think that show did too much to raise the profile of the banjo.
You mean associating with a kind of a know-nothing idiocy?
Yeah, there's a real hayseed mentality that people associate with the banjo, which is kind of silly at this point because there have been some real pioneers lately that have taken the banjo to some very cool places. Bela Fleck certainly leads the pack on that. But I think that's why people make fun of it, is they still associate it with cornfields and people in overalls and stuff like that.
You played a Grammy Award-winning tune with Bela Fleck called Leaving Cottondale. Let's listen to a little bit of that. Thank you. What's going on here, Alison Brown? You're having a good time, clearly, with Bella Fleck.
It's funny because that's a tune that I wrote and recorded on my very first record, and then right after that record came out, I was over in Japan and I met a Japanese banjo player who figured out a harmony part to the tune, and it sounded really good, so I had it in the back of my head that it'd be fun to re-record it sometime as a twin banjo tune. So when the occasion came up to put it on Fairweather, I called up Bela, and it was really cool.
So we've got the banjo coming from Africa. You've got a Japanese banjo friend. Does every country, every culture have some version of the banjo?
I'm not sure. I mean, in Japan, they have an instrument called the shamisen, which, for my money, sounds a lot like a banjo. But what's really fascinating is that bluegrass music has such wide-ranging appeal that there are actually people in Japan learning to play bluegrass music, and this particular fellow was a really good bluegrass-style banjo player.
Talk more with Alison Brown after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour to the banjo superstar Alison Brown from her latest CD, Replay. This is Mambo Banjo, a song which introduces the banjo to Latin music. In Mexico when this came to you, or how did it come around?
No, that was just one of those nice tunes that kind of descended out of the blue, really. But I wasn't really sure what direction to take it until I started playing it with David Grisman. He produced my first record, and we recorded that tune on that first record, too. And that's when it started to kind of become like a little bit Latin-flavored. But when I brought it to the quartet, and Kendrick started playing it, and John R. was playing the mambo figure behind it, it was then that I realized that I think the banjo has a lot of potential in Latin music. I mean, it's not something that you would think of off the top of your head necessarily, but it really seems to work well with the Latin grooves.
Give us a sense of, if you could pick up that banjo again, when you get off into your jazzier stream, when you're really kicking up your heels, what does that sound like, again, behind the Alison Brown Quartet? What are you doing in there?
What I could do is play a little bit of a chord melody thing that we were speaking a little bit about my daughter Hannah. This is a little lullaby that you might recognize. Kind of shows how you can play chord melodies on the banjo, much the way someone like Joe Pass might do it on the guitar.
Oh, we're all right.
See if you recognize this tune. Thank you.
think we just might recognize that. And we can hear you sliding around there. It sounds like almost like a slide.
Yeah, well, just moving kind of blocks of chords around. It's a little bit of a different approach than just playing out of open strings like the Scruggs style that I was illustrating a little bit earlier.
Did Scruggs ever do that? Was that part of his repertoire?
Well, it's hard for me to say. I mean, it seems like he could do anything with the banjo, so he may have. But as far as I'm aware, most of his recorded stuff was just kind of that quintessential bluegrass sound.
Mm-hmm. And the quartet that you bring that in behind, why the quartet? We associate it with jazz. It's got such a kind of jazz parlor sound, even with the banjo in it. That comes through loud and clear. Anytime you lay off that bluegrass pedal, suddenly, to my ear, we're moving over into jazz quartet land. Mm-hmm. Are you consciously straddling that? Is that what you're aiming for?
Well, I guess it's developed subconsciously, really. It just seemed to be that that's the best way to sort of present the music that I write, which is a little bit puzzling to me because I've never really listened to that much jazz growing up, but I really do like it. And I guess it makes some kind of sense for the banjo because the compositions are sort of leading me in that direction. Somebody described our music the other day as Bonnie and Clyde meets Charlie Brown. And I think that that kind of works because it is kind of jazz in the Vince Guaraldi sense rather than in sort of the fusion-y sense of jazz.
The astronaut connection here. You had a mash note, a kind of a fan letter from a female astronaut and ended up taking your music onto the space shuttle.
Right. Marcia Ivins is the astronaut who sent me a letter a few years ago, and I was just so tickled that to hear that she'd actually taken our records with her up into orbit on a couple of different shuttle missions. And so I wrote a tune for her specifically and was really honored when NASA used it to wake up her crew when she flew up to the Mir space station a couple of years ago.
Back here on Earth, Alison Brown, what's it like these days being a woman in the music business, both as a musician and as a business person? Is gender an issue?
Oh, you know, I prefer not to really think about that. I'm sure it could be an issue if you chose to make it one, and I just sort of believe, you know, just sort of do your best work and the right opportunities will come to you. And certainly I've benefited from the trail that all the women before me have blazed, and I know it was much harder for women to be in business, say, 30, 40 years ago than it is today. And I don't know, I don't really see gender as a negative thing. If anything, maybe it's been positive.
Because it's set you apart.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess I get to be the trailblazer for female banjo players, of which there are unfortunately still very few.
Mm-hmm. When you sit back now and think of your old gang at Smith Barney, any regrets? Do you wish you had been back on that wild ride, or have you been just where you want to be?
No, I'm just where I want to be. I feel so so fortunate to get to blend the music and business and to have been able to, in effect, create a job for myself that's sort of uniquely suited to me. I mean, it's a wonderful privilege, really.
I want to hear a little more from Replay. I liked your cut, Etouffee Brutus.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
Oh, well, my mom told me I should write a Cajun tune, so I tried to, and that's what I came up with. It's a very corny song title, but it's a lot of fun to play.
Alison Brown, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great talking to you, too.
Alison Brown's latest CD is called Replay. For more information on Alison Brown, her tour, or Compass Records, go to our website at onpointradio.org. If you'd like a free CD sampler from Compass Records featuring Alison Brown, please email your name and address to sampler@compassrecords.com. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
These two individuals are under arrest and detained on unrelated charges to the situation we've been investigating. However, we now consider them suspects in the string of shootings in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia.
We, the women, men, and children inside the theater, appeal to you to make a reasonable decision and end the war in Chechnya, she read. We have parents, sisters, and brothers, and their lives are on your conscience.
It is inevitable that nations the size of the United States and China will have differences.
像美国和中国这样大的国家之间存在分歧, 这是不可避免的。
The President and I agree that we need to resolve our differences through mutual understanding and respect.
In the first place, I do expect a council resolution, and I expect it to be unanimous. There's hard discussions going on, and I hope in the end it will be fruitful, and that the inspectors will go back to Iraq with the support of a united council behind them.
Iraqis have been told that the prisons are now empty of Iraqis, be they arrested for political reasons or for common crimes. And these relatives were coming out and saying, well, my sons and our daughters haven't come home, and they're trying to get answers about what happened to them. They want to know if they're still being held or if they died or what their whereabouts might be.
We're asking young Americans to serve in many places far from home and at great risk. We owe them every resource, every weapon, and every tool they need to fulfill their missions.
He was really a special person, a very unique man. And I think, as has been said, all of us admired this fight. We admired him in many fights, but we admired this fight. He was coming to the people of Minnesota that he loved, and he wanted their support so he could go and return to the United States Senate and fight for them. We'll miss you, Paul, and we'll never forget you.
And there's a week, the country breathed a huge sigh of relief as the suspected D.C. sniper is taken off the streets. Armed Chechen rebels hold hundreds hostage in a Moscow theater. China's President Jiang Zemin visits President Bush in Texas. Secretary General Kofi Annan remains confident the Security Council will eventually reach agreement on an Iraq resolution at the U.N. Saddam Hussein pardoned all of Iraq's prisoners. President Bush signed the largest military spending increase since the Reagan administration, a $34 billion increase, and Senator Ted Kennedy pays tribute to his friend, Senator Paul Wellstone, the Minnesota Democrat who died in a plane crash earlier today. Once again, Jack, history is just crowding every day of our lives.
It is, and a possibly historic senatorial death. Perhaps the most historic in the 20th century was the death in a duck hunting accident of Paul O. Husting of Wisconsin in 1918, just after the election. That led to a switch in parties in the Senate. The GOP took over. Senator Henry Cabot Lodge became the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and turned down, through his pressure and work, turned down the Versailles Treaty, and as Woodrow Wilson said, broke the heart of the world.
Paul Wellstone's death could lead to the same flip in party in power.
It sure could. And, you know, the question is, well, what would happen then? Well, we got a preview recently. The Washington Post reported on a meeting that had been held among GOP operatives and lobbyists from various industries. And the agenda, they sort of laid out an agenda. At the top of it was eliminating or reducing radically the corporate income tax. Another part of it was perhaps even implementing, and there was support for this, a flat tax, one feature of which would be to eliminate the deduction for mortgage interest that we in the middle class need. That would be part of a flat tax movement. Another aspect of it was to make the tax cut enacted last year permanent. And that would, of course, mean that the death tax would never again stalk America, and the 24 people in Maine who pay it every year would never have to worry about it again. And finally, the environment. It would mean definitely that the drilling would go ahead in ANWR. So a lot. And, of course, privatizing Social Security.
A lot on the line. It could be a clean sweep for Republicans in Washington.
Yeah, and all three branches of government.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jack, also this week, of course, the sniper, apparently the suspected sniper, taken into custody. And I'm struck at how just as that was happening and the nation feeling so relieved after the terrible inhumanity of what we witnessed day after day. And then we have in Moscow hundreds held hostage, not just a few, but hundreds held hostage. It's as though we can't escape this kind of dynamic of terror in the air somewhere in the world. We go right from one to the next.
Yeah, we did a show about this earlier in the week, and we were talking about it as, you know, political theater. This is the television, is the proscenium on which these crazed people and terrorists make their grievances known. We don't know what the motives of the sniper were, of course. It's a world that is more vulnerable to individual and group pathology, even insanity, I think, than it's ever been.
I'm struck by the diagram, the drawings of that sniper allegedly lying down in the trunk of his Chevy Caprice and shooting through a hole in the back. Why? We look forward to knowing that. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight and being with us all this week. Have a good weekend.
And you too, and thank you.
Listeners, a good weekend to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.